Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. To listen to Business Movers 1 week early and ad-free, join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app. Download the Wondery app in your Apple or Google Play mobile app store today. It's May 1986 in the office of Terry Elks, the CEO of Viacom. It's the start of a new work week, but already Terry is in a state because one of Viacom's shareholders, a man named Carl Icahn, has been buying up large quantities of Viacom stock, enough to threaten a hostile takeover. Frustrated, Terry picks up the phone and dials Carl.
Icahn speaking.
Carl, what do you think you're doing?
I'm sorry, who's this?
It's Terrence from Viacom.
Oh, Terry, buddy, how are you?
Well, I don't know how I am, Carl. But I think you know why I'm calling. You bought millions of shares in just a few days.
Yep, I sure did. And by my account, I own 17% of your company.
Well, I've got reporters and analysts coming out of my ears, jamming up our phone lines, asking just what the hell you're up to.
Oh, it's a free country, Terry? A man's allowed to buy stock?
You and I both know you're not interested in owning Viacom. Carl is a notorious corporate raider. He's a frequent practitioner of what Wall Street analysts call green mail, buying enough shares in a company to threaten a takeover and forcing the company to buy back the stock at a higher price in order to maintain control. You know, Carl, there are some people who might call what you do extortion.
Well, you know what I call it, Terry? Business.
Well, how about we skip the part where you act like you're not shaking us down? Just tell us what you want.
I want all the company's common stock. I'll give you $75 a share, cash.
Oh my God, you're shameless. You know that?
Look, Terry, I'm sorry to be the one to tell you, but this is how it goes. It isn't my fault. Viacom's management doesn't know how to run a company profitably. But I'm an investor in Viacom, so it is my problem.
Oh, and you think you could run this company? Tell me, Carl, how's Transworld Airlines going? Carl sighs angrily into the phone. He's the chairman of Transworld Airlines, the intercontinental airline founded by Howard Hughes. But things there have been turbulent the past few weeks. Between a dip in ticket sales and labor strikes, Carl has lost millions of dollars.
Oh, go take a nap, Terrence. You don't know what you're talking about.
No, you don't know what you're talking about. Viacom is doing fine, Carl. We don't want you, we don't need you, and we're not going to pay you a penny. Back off now, or I'll come at you with everything I've got. Terry was right to suspect Carl was attempting to greenmail Viacom, but he might have pushed things too far. And certainly underestimated his opponent. By 1986, Carl was an expert at corporate raiding. Over the course of his career, he initiated well over a dozen major takeover battles, and nearly every time, he walked away with a greenmail payment. His battle with Viacom would be no different. Despite Terry's best efforts, Viacom ultimately caved to Carl's demands and bought back his shares at a premium. In total, they paid Carl $217 million. Terry and the rest of Viacom's management were humiliated and worried. For one thing, Viacom had to borrow money to pay Carl off, leaving the company with significant debt. But more importantly, Terry was worried that what happened with Carl might happen again with other corporate raiders down the line. So in order to insulate the company, Terry took a drastic measure. He assembled a group of investors from inside and outside the ranks of the company's management. And under Terry's leadership, this consortium of investors would set out to try and purchase all of the company's shares to take Viacom private. This decision would anger many Viacom shareholders who wanted the company to remain public, and among them, a Boston-born movie theater mogul named Sumner Redstone. In the aftermath of Carl's greenmail scheme, Sumner would set out to block Terry's efforts and take Viacom for himself.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
From Wondery, I'm Lindsey Graham, and this is Business Movers. Terry's plan to take Viacom private was not unique. It was a common defensive measure in the 1980s, a decade that saw a rash of hostile, destabilizing corporate takeovers, each resulting in substantial layoffs and burdensome corporate debt. The costly dual threat of green mail on one hand and an actual takeover on the other was enough to convince Terry to take drastic measures with Viacom. Public companies have shares that can be bought and sold at a stock exchange by any able and interested investor. This gives those companies greater access to working capital, but it also means the company's management has to answer to a board of directors who represents the interests of a large number of shareholders. A private company, on the other hand, doesn't trade stock on an exchange, and it doesn't have public shareholders. Instead, it's owned by a tighter circle of investors, which gives the company's management more control over the company's future. Terry knew that going private would protect him from outside influence and from future corporate raiders. There was one investor in particular who gave Terry pause, Sumner Redstone. At the time, Sumner owned National Amusements, a chain of movie theaters he inherited from his father in the 1950s. Sumner turned a handful of drive-ins across New York and New England into a sprawling set of indoor multiplexes across the country. But Sumner wanted more. His ambition was fueled by a business philosophy that would be the hallmark of his career. Content is king. And for Sumner, the best way to thrive in the content business was to get into television. Viacom was an obvious target. The media company owned syndication rights to a large library of classic shows like Matlock, I Love Lucy, and The Cosby Show. It also had original programming on networks like MTV and Nickelodeon. Sumner saw tremendous potential in Viacom. So in 1985, he started buying up the company's stock aggressively. By the fall of 86, Sumner owned nearly 10% of all outstanding shares. But then, in September of that year, Sumner learned that Viacom CEO Terry Elkes was leading a charge to try and take the company private. Sumner was furious. He invested in Viacom because of its long-term potential. Now Terry was pushing him and other investors out the door. So Sumner set out to protect his long-term investment by convincing Terry he was making a mistake. Short of that, Sumner was fully prepared to take drastic measures of his own. This is the second episode in our four-part series on Sumner Redstone, The Battle for Viacom. It's September 1986 in a high-end steakhouse in New York City, 3 months after Carl Icahn's green mail scheme. Sumner Redstone follows a maitre d' to a private room in the back. He's on his way to meet with Viacom CEO Terry Elkes. As he walks through the restaurant, Sumner tries to keep a cool head, but he's seething. Just days ago, Sumner read in the New York Daily News that Terry and a consortium of investors are attempting to buy Viacom for $2.7 billion and take the company private. If Terry convinces the board to take the deal, it's bad news for Sumner. Sumner owns a 9% stake in the company, and he feels Terry's offer of $40 a share is too low. Sumner is confident that if the company stays public, he and the rest of the shareholders will make far more money. So Sumner called this meeting with Terry to make his feelings known. As maitre d' opens the door, Sumner storms in and skips the pleasantries.
"Seems like you want to freeze me out, Terry." "Hell of a way to greet a man, Sumner."
Sumner takes a seat across from Terry. As Terry takes a sip from his glass of scotch, Sumner fiddles with something in his jacket pocket. Then he pulls out a recent newspaper.
"Imagine my surprise when I opened up the paper and saw that you and your cronies want to take the company private. Look at this, Terry. Right here, in the business section, it says you're trying to steal Viacom for $2.7 billion.
"I know what it says, Sumner.
I made the offer, so I don't need you to read it to me. Your shareholders would get pocket change. I would get pocket change. 9% of $2.7 billion isn't pocket change. It is compared to what I'm missing out on down the line. What kind of position are you putting me in? What position do you think we're in, Sumner? You saw how the Carl thing went down. Oh, come on, Terry. Is that what you're worried about? That's just Carl. Everyone knows he's in this thing purely for himself. Everybody's in it for themselves, Sumner, and that's including you. That's exactly why we're going private. We can't take another $217 million on the chin. With the amount of debt we have, why should we stay public and risk having another highway bandit like Carl shake us down? Terry, listen to me. The answer to your problems is not going private. It's growing what you already have. You've got a good thing at Viacom. Stacks and stacks of old shows and movies you can syndicate. Plus, I like this Nickelodeon and MTV stuff. All the money in the world is right there. Nah, this buyout is the best way to protect the company. No. It's the best way to protect you. Come on, Sumner. You keep an iron grip on National Amusements. You know what this is. Don't fault me for trying to do the same thing. National Amusements isn't a public company. And certainly not a public company trying to go private. I like you, Terry. But I'm not going to let you do this. Especially with a lowball offer. It's a matter of principle. And I need you to understand that. If you go this round, I'm going to fight you every step of the way. Oh, I understand perfectly, Sumner, but let me tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to look out for my company, and you worry about yours. In Sumner's mind, he was thinking about National Amusements. Sumner felt that the movie theater business was a no-growth industry. He believed National Amusements' future was in content, which is exactly why he invested heavily in Viacom in the first place. He wasn't about to let Terry deprive him of the fruits of that investment. So Sumner set out on a campaign to thwart Terry's efforts, and he started with Viacom's board of directors. Sumner knew that it was Viacom's board of directors and not Terry that would ultimately decide whether or not to take the company private. So in order to succeed at blocking it, Sumner would have to convince them that Terry was making a mistake. But Sumner was new to the Viacom fold. He lacked institutional knowledge, and he had few friends on the inside. He was just a lone shareholder with a comparatively minor stake in the company. What he needed was to get the board's attention. So Sumner approached another Viacom shareholder, an investment firm called Coniston Partners, and asked them if they wanted to make a deal. Coniston was more than willing to sell, but Sumner had to proceed with caution. He wanted to grow his influence and his ownership in Viacom, but he couldn't buy all of Coniston's shares, or anyone else's for that matter, because Viacom's corporate bylaws included what's known as a poison pill. A poison pill is an anti-takeover measure, a defensive mechanism designed to make buying a controlling stake in a company so costly that most investors couldn't or wouldn't attempt it. In Viacom's case, the poison pill activated when any one shareholder passed 20% ownership of the company. At that point, every other shareholder would receive more shares or have the opportunity to purchase them at a discount. Sumner owned 9% of Viacom. Coniston Partners owned 12%. If Sumner bought all of Coniston's stock, he would own 21%, triggering the poison pill and diluting the power of his shares. So instead, Sumner bought just enough stock from Coniston to gain an 18% stake in Viacom. It was small enough to avoid the poison pill, but hopefully substantial enough to make Sumner's presence known. Immediately, the press, market analysts, and spectators did take notice, and Sumner's purchase caused Viacom stock to rise. Terry knew that a higher stock price meant his $2.7 billion offer to take the company private would no longer suffice. So Terry upped his price to $2.9 billion. Meanwhile, Sumner succeeded in getting the attention he wanted. Equipped with more stock, nearly a fifth of the company, Sumner set out to make his case to the board. But he also knew he couldn't speak directly to them. In order to avoid any appearance of impropriety, the Viacom board had appointed a special outside committee to evaluate all bids for Viacom, including Terry's. So in October, Sumner sat down for a meeting with a representative from this committee. In the meeting, Sumner argued that Viacom's assets, in particular its channels like MTV and Nickelodeon, had far too much potential for the company to go private. If the board was looking out for shareholders, Sumner argued, then they should reject the $2.9 billion offer, stay public, and let Viacom's assets carry the company into the future.
Also in the meeting, Sumner argued that the decision to take Viacom private represented poor leadership on Terry's part. Viacom had a bright future, but only if it were managed by someone who wanted to take full advantage of its content. Sumner explained that if Terry was unwilling to do what it would take to grow Viacom as a public company, then someone else would have to take charge. Sumner, of course, had a man in mind, himself. Sumner left the meeting confident he had made a strong impression on the committee representative. But just days later, Sumner was astounded when the press reported that Viacom's board had approved Terry's $2.9 billion bid. Sumner was outraged. He would later write, "I felt the brunt of that impropriety. I owned 18% of the company, and management had given very short shrift to my views. I didn't like the board's attitude. I didn't like Terry Elk's attitude. I didn't like the way I was being treated." Sumner began to suspect that the impartial outside committee was anything but. He came to believe that they would always push the board in Terry's direction. So Sumner decided to beat Terry at his own game. If he couldn't win the committee over, he could make an offer that the board simply could not refuse. Sumner had a team ready to go. A financial advisor from Merrill Lynch named Ken Miller, and a lawyer from the law firm Shearman & Sterling named Philippe Dumont, who Sumner liked and saw a bit of himself in. Philippe had excelled academically in school, like Sumner, and displayed a great deal of ambition in his work, like Sumner. Philippe was quick, smart, insightful, Sumner wrote. He spoke easily, with sharp intelligence and an understated wit. I evaluate people based on their ability, judgment, and confidence, and he topped the list on all three counts. It was a successful working relationship and mutual admiration that would last the rest of Sumner's life. So with Philippe and Ken by his side, Sumner set out to secure funding in order to make a counteroffer to Terry's bid. At first, Sumner considered looking for an acquisition partner, another company who could put up money and help him win the bidding war. But he quickly decided against that approach. Sumner didn't want a partner. He had a clear vision for the future of Viacom. He planned to double down on content, investing time and resources in Viacom's television networks. Sumner felt that a partner could potentially stand in the way of that vision. He also knew that any potential partner would have to take on debt to get the deal done. As a result, he feared that a debt-saddled partner might be inclined to sell off some of Viacom's assets, including their TV networks, to pay down what they owe. Doing that would run counter to Sumner's content-first strategy. So he decided it was better to go it alone. Meanwhile, Terry was getting nervous. He knew Sumner could bring tremendous resources to bear in a bidding war. Sumner's ability to borrow would be bolstered by National Amusement's $400 million in assets, especially their valuable real estate holdings. By contrast, Terry and his consortium didn't have much equity to speak of. Their $2.9 billion bid was largely backed by borrowed money and low-rated securities. Junk bonds like these pay high yields to investors like Terry and the rest of the consortium, but they're also extremely risky, since chances of default, getting no money at all, are significantly higher. As a result, Terry feared that Sumner's offer would appear a safer, sure bet. So while Sumner set out to secure funding, Terry Elks and his consortium decided to try and make an enemy a friend and extended Sumner an olive branch.
Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Get up to 30% off well-crafted and personalized gifts from participating shops until May 12th. This year, embrace your creative side. You know, the side your mom gave you. And shop Etsy for custom jewelry, style pieces, home decor, and extra special items she'll adore. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, places, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
It's December 1986, in Viacom's offices in New York City, 6 months after Carl Icahn's green mail attempt. Terry Elkes and members of his consortium are gathered waiting for Sumner Redstone to arrive. They're having one last huddle before the meeting kicks off. The plan is to sit back and let Terry do the talking. And soon enough, Sumner, his lawyer Philippe, and his financial advisor Ken stride into the room. Once everyone shakes hands and takes their seats, Terry leads off the meeting.
I appreciate you stopping by, Sumner.
Well, sure, Terry, of course. Now, what can I do for you?
Well, I want to tell you first that the situation has not fundamentally changed. And it will not fundamentally change. We still have every intention of buying Viacom and taking it private, because we believe that's the best way to secure Viacom's future.
Sumner's smile falls into a grimace.
You're making a big mistake, Terry. Look, Sumner, I now realize you are far more tenacious than I gave you credit for. Terry, you're putting me on a roller coaster here. First you break my heart, now you're flattering me?
The men in the room chuckle, but Terry stays on task.
No, Sumner, not flattery, just observation. I think the way forward for us is not to fight, but to join forces.
Sumner exchanges curious glances with Philippe and Ken. None of them were expecting this.
What does that mean exactly, Terry? Well, as you know, Sumner, my team is just one partner in a large consortium of buyers. That said, after we take Viacom private, my team will control a sizable percentage of the company.
Yes, I'm aware of that. So what are you offering?
Well, I'm prepared to offer you as much as 50% of my team's holdings after the Viacom board accepts the consortium's bid.
And how much stock will you and your team own in this private Viacom of yours?
$50 million worth.
Well, that's an offer.
What's the catch?
There's no catch, Sumner. Just terms.
Okay, and what are the terms?
To date, your role at Viacom has been mostly passive. You've put in your money, and now I've done my job, which is to run Viacom in a way that makes that money grow.
So you want me totally passive, not an ounce of opinion.
I'll be looking for your investment, Sumner. That's my job.
Okay. Let me make something clear to you, Terrence. First of all, I am not Carl Icahn. This isn't just about dollars to me. So if you think you can buy me off with a paper-thin slice of your private company, you've got another thing coming. $25 million worth of stock is not paper thin, Sumner. And second of all, you and I both know that you and the rest of the consortium had to borrow up to your eyelids to get the money for this deal. The only way you're going to be able to pay all that money back is to gut Viacom, to chop it up, sell all the best parts to pay down your debts.
What I do with my company is none of your concern.
Except it's not your company. Not for much longer. I am not a passive person, Terrence. I don't want half of what you and your team own. I want Viacom.
Terry's attempts to win Sumner to his side were in vain. Soon, tensions between the two men would simmer even further. Sumner would allege that Terry called him a peasant from Boston behind his back. And it might be true, Sumner did little to hide his disdain for Terry and the rest of the consortium. Soon, that tension would break into an all-out corporate war. In February of 1987, Sumner put forward his first bid to buy Viacom. Dollar for dollar, it was about the same as Terrence's $2.9 billion bid, but Sumner felt his offer was superior, primarily because he believed that National Amusements assets made his bid far more secure. Wall Street seemed to agree. The day that National Amusements put forward their offer, Viacom's stock began to rise. But unfortunately for Sumner, it wasn't enough to convince the Viacom board. After nearly a week of deliberations, the board rejected Sumner's bid. They claimed to be concerned about regulatory hurdles involving the transfer of broadcasting licenses, but Sumner didn't buy it. He believed the real reason was favoritism. Sumner suspected that the committee was conspiring with Terry to undermine him and the rest of the shareholders and hand the company to the consortium. Soon, Sumner would learn a piece of information that would reinforce that suspicion.
In the midst of the bidding war, Sumner felt it was important to find out as much information as he could about the inner workings of Viacom. So he reached out to Bob Pittman, a former MTV executive who recently left the company. As Sumner hounded Bob with questions, he learned that many of the executives at MTV shared his distaste for Terry and the rest of Viacom's management. The relationship between MTV and Viacom had been rocky from the very start. In 1985, MTV's management tried to buy themselves out from their previous owner, a media company called Warner Amex Cable. But Viacom stepped in at the last minute and bought up the young network. It was a culture clash from the very beginning. Many employees at MTV felt that Viacom's executives, including Terry, didn't know how to talk to creatives. According to Bob, MTV was hemorrhaging talent as a result. Sumner felt vindicated. The dissatisfaction at MTV only proved his point. Viacom was in desperate need of a new direction and a new leader. But Sumner wanted to know more. So Bob put Sumner in touch with a current MTV executive named Tom Freston. Soon, Sumner and Tom met for dinner at Sumner's apartment at the Carlisle Hotel in New York. At the dinner, the two men got on well. So much so that near the end of the meal, Tom invited Sumner to drop by the MTV offices for a visit. But in doing so, Tom was putting himself in harm's way. Tom relayed to Sumner that the higher-ups at Viacom had informed the staff at MTV and other Viacom networks that if anyone talked to Sumner Redstone, they would be fired. Tom made it clear that if Sumner came by the office, he would have to keep a low profile. Sumner understood completely and promised to be discreet. When he arrived at MTV's New York offices, Sumner was greeted by Tom and a woman named Geraldine Laybourne, the head of programming at Nickelodeon. As Sumner took a tour of the office, he noticed that the walls were lined with posters for bands and celebrities he'd never heard of before. But there was something that Sumner did recognize, and that was the massive appeal of channels like MTV and Nickelodeon to their young, loyal audiences. Sumner saw that with networks like these, Viacom was sitting on a modern-day goldmine. During his tour of MTV, Tom and Geraldine weren't shy about their frustrations with Viacom's management. Near the end of the visit, Sumner asked Tom and Geraldine a direct question. He wanted to know if they would leave if National Amusements took control of Viacom. Both Tom and Geraldine saw a takeover by National Amusements as a chance to finally break free from current management. So their answer was they would stay, both of them. Sumner was inspired and reinvigorated by his visit to MTV, and he left determined to win. Not long after, he upped his bid to $3.2 billion. Sumner believed that figure would be a knockout blow for Terry, and he expected the board would make their decision quickly. But much to his dismay, the board did not give him a prompt response. Instead, they spent days deliberating. And then, the committee announced that they would also be considering a brand new offer from Terry for $3.1 billion. Sumner was furious. In his mind, he had put forward superior bids at every turn. But each time, he felt, the committee had deliberately dragged their feet in order to give Terry enough time to make a counteroffer. And Terry's offer wasn't even competitive, a full $100 million below his price. Sumner's suspicions were further confirmed when he raised his bid one more time to $3.3 billion. But once again, the committee dragged its feet until Terry countered. This time, Terry's offer was $3.23 billion, but still $700,000 below Sumner's. This was all the proof Sumner needed that the special committee was conspiring against him. As Sumner regrouped with his advisors, he realized he was in a precarious position. The bidding process was stretching him to his financial limits, and there was no apparent end in sight. Sumner still wanted Viacom, but he was beginning to doubt if staying in the game was worth it. Sumner would later write, "The business of Viacom would have to do extraordinarily well in order to support the increased weight of the debt I'd be taking on." But Sumner was not afraid of big risks. In fact, he relished them. But he was also self-aware. Was his pursuit of Viacom a smart business deal? Or was he acting, in his words, crazy? In his hour of doubt, Sumner turned to his team, his advisor Ken and his lawyer Philippe. Sumner told the two of them he wouldn't do the deal unless they assured him he wasn't crazy and he was making a smart decision. Philippe and Ken both encouraged Sumner to press on. With his confidence renewed, Sumner increased his bid again, this time to $3.4 billion. But Sumner included something else with his offer, too, a letter to the committee accusing them of anti-competitive conspiratorial activity. In this letter, Sumner explained that it was obvious to him that Terry and the consortium were behaving in negotiations as if they knew they had an upper hand. He wrote that the management must have the sense that it need not have the best offer in order to win. The shareholders will not stand for such a result. This letter was more than just Sumner's venting. It was a legal threat. Long before Sumner was a media mogul, he graduated top of his class at Harvard Law, where he learned all about the ins and outs of corporate governance. This knowledge served him well when he worked as a lawyer for the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., and it served him again when he took on the Hollywood studios early in his career. In the wake of his $3.4 billion offer, Sumner would bring this knowledge and experience to bear yet again. The same day he sent the letter, Sumner picked up the phone and called the head of the special committee. On the call, Sumner would make his intentions clear. If the board did not accept the best offer on the table, Sumner would see them all in court.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
It's March 2nd, 1987, in the office of Alan Johnson, the head of Viacom's special committee. Alan's just returned from a meeting with the rest of the committee members. As he sits down at his desk, his secretary buzzes in and informs him he has a call on line one. It's Sumner Redstone. Alan sighs and picks up the receiver. Sumner, hello there. Alan Johnson here. What can I do for you?
Well, Alan, I was calling to see if you received my letter.
I did, Sumner. I'm looking at it right now.
And did you read it?
I sure did.
Any thoughts?
Alan takes a deep breath. He's annoyed by the letter, but he knows he has to choose his words carefully. Well, Sumner, let me just address the thrust of it. Neither Viacom's board nor the committee, of which I am chair, have given Terrence Elks or Viacom's management preferential treatment. Everything has been by the letter, all above board.
Terry's playing with risky money, and you know it. Meanwhile, here I am, out in the cold, with a good, hard offer. A firm offer.
Sumner, if you're talking about the high-risk bonds, you know full well that they're a perfectly legitimate way to finance an acquisition. It's my understanding that you're using them yourself.
To make up a small difference, Alan. But they aren't the foundation of National Amusement's bid. Don't try to turn this around on me.
I'm not trying to do anything, Sumner. You called me.
Because you didn't respond to my letter.
Alan hoped to de-escalate the situation, but in the heat of the moment, he loses his cool. Well, it hasn't even been a day, Sumner. You know what? Fine. Let's go over your letter a little bit, shall we? Let's see. Oh, you're saying we're slow-rolling all of your offers because we're giving Terrence, in your words, the opportunity to learn the contents of the offer and to respond by not making a superior offer, but rather an inferior offer. I find this insulting, Sumner.
No, I'm the one who's insulted. It would be one thing if Terry were actually putting up better bids. Then I could understand you circling the wagons, but his offer is lower than mine. So don't act insulted that I'm suggesting your actions are less than above board.
Sumner, watch it. I was prepared to let the letter go, but you're accusing the committee. You're accusing me and Terry and Viacom management of egregious things here. Please, don't say anything you can't take back.
Well, Ali, you know, if the shoe fits... I don't know what kind of insurance you and your committee have, but whatever it is, it's not enough to cover you when I take every single one of you to court.
Sumner's threat worked. The very next day, Alan called Sumner back and asked him what he wanted. Sumner replied that above all, he wanted the process to finally come to an end. He wanted additional offers from either party halted immediately, and he wanted the committee to make a final decision based on the current offers by the end of the following day, March 4th. Alan agreed, and so did Terry. The next day, Sumner, Philippe, and Ken hunkered down at the Viacom offices while the board deliberated. After waiting for hours, Sumner grew impatient and went home while Philippe and Ken stood by waiting for a response. While Sumner was away, a representative from the committee informed Philippe and Ken that at the last moment, Terry had increased his bid by $1 per share. Immediately, Philippe and Ken passed word along to Sumner via telephone. Livid, Sumner was fully prepared to unleash on the committee again, but Philippe and Ken talked him down. They assured Sumner that all was well. The committee members made it clear they understood Terry had violated the terms of the negotiation. His new bid would not be considered. So at the end of the day, on March 4th, after a 12-hour deliberation, Sumner finally received the official word. The board had accepted his offer. National Amusements would pay $3.4 billion, and in return, Sumner would become the majority shareholder. Viacom was in Sumner's grasp, along with its extremely valuable networks. But Sumner was the first to admit he knew nothing about the business of making television. So begrudgingly, he left Terry in place as CEO, hoping for a smooth transition. But the detente didn't last long. Sumner claimed that Terry continued to conspire against him, keeping him out of important meetings, effectively shutting Sumner out. Eventually, Sumner fired Terry and replaced him with an executive from outside the company. And with new top management, Sumner began to make good on his promise to put content first. With revenue from reruns of shows in Viacom's library, Sumner was able to pay down a healthy portion of the debt he accrued during the acquisition. And the next few years would see the development of hit shows like MTV Unplugged, Rugrats, Doug, and Ren and Stimpy. Viacom was on an upward trajectory, and Sumner was riding high. He had started his career with a handful of drive-ins in the northeastern United States, and now he was sitting at the head of a burgeoning media giant. With Viacom's production and broadcasting assets, Sumner was one step closer to his dream of a fully diversified and vertically integrated National Amusements. But the good news came with the bad. Not long after the Viacom board approved Sumner's offer, Sumner received word that his father, Mickey, had passed away. Mickey was elderly, but the news was shocking nonetheless. Sumner's father had started National Amusements 50 years prior, but now wouldn't be alive to see the company's biggest victory come to fruition. His father was gone, and his brother had long since left the company behind. Sumner was now the only one of the original Redstone men remaining at National Amusements, a company that had finally broken into television, but had started as a movie theater business. As far back as the 1950s, Sumner had bemoaned the fact that theater exhibitors had little to no control over the films they showed. At trade conferences and in interviews with the press, Sumner frequently offered a solution, suggesting that theater owners should be able to produce and distribute their own films. Many exhibitors delighted in Sumner's dream. Many others scoffed at it. They knew that antitrust laws made that dream all but impossible. But in those earliest days, Sumner was just a low-level exhibitor. Now he was sitting atop a media empire. With Viacom in his pocket, Sumner would set out to make his cinematic dream a reality by acquiring another Hollywood behemoth, Paramount. From Wondery, this is episode 2 in our 4-part series on Sumner Redstone. On the next episode of Business Movers, Sumner uses the weight of his growing media empire to try and acquire Paramount. But when his plans are thwarted by another buyer, Sumner finds himself on the defense. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Business Movers ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey. If you'd like to learn more about Sumner Redstone, we recommend The King of Content by Keech Hagee and A Passion to Win by Sumner Redstone. A quick note about our dramatizations. In most cases, we can't know everything that happened, but all our reenactments are based on historical research. Business Movers is hosted, edited, and executive produced by me, Lindsey Graham, for Airship. Audio editing by Molly Bach. Sound design by Derek Behrens. Music by Lindsey Graham. This episode is written and researched by Dante Flores. Executive producers are Stephen Walters for Airship and Jenny Lauer Beckman and Marshall Louis for Wondery.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used. Because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.